to the happy hour. I'm your host, Tony Yang, and joining me today, as usual, are my fellow compatriots, Alex Cortez and Clark Price. How are you both doing?
Good.
I'm doing well. Day three into leave or rest, you know, from work. So it's a strange feeling after, 2 years of nonstop?
Yeah. Some break time is greatly appreciated, and I'm looking forward to getting some vacation time here soon too. I'm a little bit burning out at all ends as well. But as frequently as we say on this show, what is not tired, and certainly not tired of us, is coronavirus. And one of the interesting articles that kind of came out, and I kind of want to get both of your views on this, is an article that came out on Monday in the Washington Post by Francis Stead Sellers, that's entitled "COVID is making flu and other common viruses act in unfamiliar ways," which is kind of interesting, because early on during the pandemic, one of the major concerns was the potential of a twindemic, where you have COVID and flu, except that the flu never really showed up. Part of that is kind of interesting, I think. And Alex, maybe you can sort of explain why this is all a little bit weird, but it's kind of caused the article really kind of points out that the seasonality of some of these diseases, such as respiratory simplex viruses, flu, are not all out of whack. And some of that is a combination of the competitiveness of COVID, but also the mitigation efforts of human beings has kind of changed the cycle of these diseases. And so it's just kind of making it really strange for our cycle of colds during the annual, you know, sort of cycle. So, Alex, your thoughts?
Well, thanks, Tony. I think a lot of it, it's a reflection of the change in behavior. So the fact that things are looking different, well, we're acting different too. And I think largely the mitigation efforts, I'm not going to dismiss the impacts, the physiological impacts of, you know, maybe long-term effects that coronavirus is having on individuals that might lead to co-infections or infections post-COVID, where your body's just changed. I mean, we just don't know enough of it, and there's going to be a lot of data being generated in the next, data should be available. Like, if people start looking for it to try to better understand what's happening. But I think largely it has to do with just behavioral shifts, you know, for a lot of folks staying at home, away from crowds to some degree, and sort of this kind of variation, like comfort levels, masking. But I mean, if you think about things like externalities of just some response to something, for instance, masks, which are proven very effective in, you know, controlling or slowing down transmission of the virus and other viruses. But at the same time, we're also probably putting the brakes on some of the milder infections you would get before, and that we probably rely on to keep that our immune system challenge are going. So I think you're seeing some of that too. I still stand by masks and how effective they are, but I think we need to be collecting more information, more data to figure out the nuances of things, and, you know, when it's appropriate, or think of other ways of challenging our immune system so it stays aware of other illnesses, not just corona. There's other stuff out there, and that we've been naturally exposed to, and I think as Corona becomes endemic, just like these other illnesses, you probably will have a more normalcy, but you know, there's always a risk of something new emerging that I think that's going to be inherent, especially in this globalized society.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of lessons moving forward with this. Clark, what are some of your thoughts on this?
I agree with what Alex has said. There's behavioral things, masking, I think, most important, but consciousness of the disease transmission. Also, there's a study that came out late last year, COVID-19 vaccines may protect against other coronaviruses. So may protect, not necessarily does, but it's something that's possible and is out there. Definitive information is not. Let's see, the study showed that antibodies in plasma from humans who had been vaccinated against COVID-19 reacted to SARS-CoV-1, commonly referred to as SARS, and the common cold. It also showed that mice vaccinated against SARS had an immune response when exposed to COVID-19, and that previous coronavirus infections can also protect against other coronaviruses. So that would be consistent with what we are seeing out there in the public health sphere. So I think that there's that. But also there's this aspect of this mysterious capacity of COVID-19 and the variants to produce illnesses over a wide range of physiological aspects. The venous system, so upper circulatory system, nervous system, muscles. It's an insidious disease. But as I look over the whole thing over the last couple of years, I think we, in a way, that humanity should be very grateful that coronavirus was as benign as it has been. I mean, it's killed in the United States over 1 million people, and worldwide quite a few people. And the disease is raging elsewhere, which actually is having an effect on us, on our economics in this country. But I think this should be considered to be a warning, and that much worse could happen to the human race than COVID-19. And we have to stop being stupid as a people. We have to stop believing in horrible leaders like Donald Trump. And we have to listen to scientists and science, because that's the only thing that's going to help. And calling something a hoax while it's just chewing up the world is insane. And that's got to come to an end. So I hope that this is a warning and a wake-up call to people who'd rather be in ignorance, because ignorance will result in you and your family and your friends dying. So disease is a reality. Common sense tells us that. And common sense should tell us that we need good leadership. That means people who are not like Donald Trump, who is probably the worst major leader in modern history outside of, you know, a third world dictator or Adolf Hitler. So also, yeah, I don't believe you mentioned that Anthony Fauci has contracted COVID, which I'd like to know how that happened, because is he actively treating patients? Because that'd be a way to become infected. He avoided the National Press Club's dinner because he thought it might be, I think it was, a super spreader, and I mean, he seems to be smart about, I mean, obviously, about viral transmission, is particularly this virus. And I'd be very curious to know how that happened, or if it's just an accidental transmission, you know, casual, like, oh, you went to the store and you were masked and you still got it, which means if Anthony Fauci can get it, we can get it. And I guess, Alex, you've had it. I have not. Yeah. Tony, you have not as well, right?
No. You know, the COVID infectiousness is not quite to where measles level infectiousness is, but it's pretty darn close. It's highly infectious. And the common cold, you want to keep in mind, is also a distant cousin. It is a coronavirus, but it's a very different cousin.
Yeah, that's hence the efficacy of anti COVID-19 affecting things like the common cold.
Right. But it is to sort of say, like, it's that level of infectiousness that you can it wouldn't take a lot, and it doesn't take a lot for you to get exposed and potentially catch it. And so I think that's one aspect of this that's COVID, and particularly the Omicron variant and its subvariants, has evolved to be fairly infectious. And it's not unrealistic that with a imperfect vaccine and an imperfect layer of protection, with something that is very fairly infectious, you can get it pretty easily. And the numbers of people who have it right now are very high as well. And I think that's probably some place where he was exposed to it. I think
what is the infection rate that we're seeing contemporaneously with respect to the Inland Empire and other areas where we have University of California campuses?
Well, it's higher actually in the San Francisco Bay Area than it is in the larger LA and Orange County and Southern California area.
Could be the more concentrated population.
No, there are some discussions. If you listen to George Rutherford out of UC San Francisco, there might be some level of herd immunity, because a lot of people got Omicron in LA because they didn't heed. Yeah. There's less sort of population habits. There were less public health habits in the LA area, right? And Alex, you might be able to explain more about that.
Well, I think it's consistent with what I said earlier about how the masking efforts and not being exposed to things. Eventually, you'll see it. You know, it's like if you're a vulnerable population, but you've avoided something just out of your behavior, but you don't remove the risk is still around. The moment that risk enters your life, you're not exempt from it. So, you know, that's why you see it. Like, just because it was an otherwise, I would say, pristine environment for people that were not previously infected, or especially folks that may have not even been vaccinated. But I would imagine the rates are pretty high in that area too. But you got to remember that the vaccine is no guarantee that you're not going to get infected. It's just how severe of an illness are you gonna develop. And that's the same thing with, you know, things like the flu. I mean, the flu's been around for a long time. Many of us have had the flu, but we haven't died from it. Yet some people die from it. So it's because you either your flu shot may not have worked perfectly and you still contracted it and felt sick, but you didn't die from it. You're seeing the same thing with with COVID, plus, yeah, I mean, and these are two serious illnesses and deadly, but they're not at the apex of deadliness when it comes to viral infections, like in Ebola, for instance.
Right. And, you know, and looking at some of the data from the NIH, COVID's R not number is somewhere between 12 and 18, at least the Omicron variant, which is the next thing closest to measles. So it's not as infectious as measles, but it's pretty darn close in terms of infectiousness. And if you put everybody in a room unvaccinated with someone who has an active case of measles, about 99% of the people in that room will contract it. So this is highly infectious, and it's highly likely that you can get it anywhere. And so that's something to kind of keep a watch on with that. So Clark, keep your activities as safe as possible, right?
Yeah, I really love the band Steely Dan, and I bought over a year ago tickets to see them. Well, it's mm-hmm. It's Donald Fagen, and so I wanted to go see them at the Hollywood Bowl. And I'm so distracted, I'm so busy, I actually forgot and did not go after a year and a half of holding these tickets and waiting for the show. And so I'm sort of rationalizing it by saying, well, you know what? I could have gone to this event where it's a sold out thing and there's lots of people there and gotten COVID. So maybe fate and my forgetfulness and distraction saved me from dying. That's how I'm rationalizing it. I still really regret not going.
It probably would have been safe. I mean, it's 10 times less.
Yeah, don't say that. I want to have some rationale for
that. That's a good rationale. It's a good rationale.
Wrong now.
Yeah. No. The other big news story today is the Fed, the Federal Reserve Bank, decided to hike up interest rates by 0.75 percentage point. Please don't buy a house, take out a car loan, et cetera, at this point, because interest rates will probably go up in the foreseeable future.
I think that's a high interest rate at this point, but there's been much higher. I mean, going back to the late 70s and 80s, I think it was 10%.
Yeah, so. I heard about mortgage rates that were at 24% interest.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's hard to believe. I mean, people need housing. This is the thing about it. And so there will still be, it will be a depressed market, but there will be people buying and selling houses. And that's just, it's part of life.
Yeah, I think it's actually, well, you know, for certainly someone in my lifetime and probably even in Alex's lifetime, this is the worst inflation has been.
Yeah, that's I mean, probably right.
And you forget I moved to the U.S. from Mexico. Oh,
this is true. This is true. You were in Mexico in the 80s. That is probably even worse than anything Americans have experienced.
Yeah, you don't want to see that here.
Well, the same. I see a lot of political aspects to this whole thing that I think are very unfortunate. And it's, you know, I don't think it's surprising that people who are MAGA people who are foolish enough to support Donald Trump. And if you look at the news reports out today, that his grifting on Stop the Steal, which is a complete and utter 100% fraud, has mostly retirees on fixed incomes of providing him with $250 million of money that he is just, you know, rolling around in like a hog in slop. And so, I mean, it's not surprising that people who support him and fall for his cons and lies and grifts believe that somehow He had nothing to do with the situation that we are in now economically, and it's all let's go Brandon Joe Biden stuff. That is just absolutely false. Again, and no surprise to anybody who's moderately informed by some other source of quote news unquote other than Fox News. And that is, here we are after this horribly mismanaged pandemic. And so there's all this pent up market energy and demand that was not present when people are, you know, holed up in their homes and we're all remote and all this other stuff and not going out except for very limited purposes. So there's that demand. And then you've got COVID inflamed elsewhere in the world where there are production issues. And so you have, that's the supply part of it. And then the demand part is huge in the United States, while important sectors of the world are still dealing with COVID. And then you also have the insanity of Vladimir Putin attacking Ukraine and how that has completely disrupted the world's food supply and the energy supplies in Europe. So, and then of course, those energy supplies have to be met elsewhere. And then that's where you're interrupting a normal supply chain to the United States. So, and also that's all real.
Yeah.
This part is not necessarily real. And I would say that I think there are people in the world who want to defeat Biden and maybe restore Trump. And I'll tell you one suspect I have for that, besides Putin, obviously, because Putin benefits enormously by having Trump in power in the United States, because Trump is so incompetent and destructive that he single-handedly has greatly diminished the United States vis-a-vis Russia. But that the person I'm holding up as a suspect here would be Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia. And of course, we have enormous profits that Saudi Arabia is reaping right now. And they are controlling the supply of oil. By the way, Saudi Arabia is number two in terms of oil reserves in the world, with number one being, gentlemen,
the United States.
No, Venezuela.
That's kidding.
Not the United States, but the United States.
What is number one producer?
The United States is not, does have a reserve of oil.
Yeah.
And it's not completely off the list, but it's pretty low.
The interesting thing I think about this particular period of stagflation that I think we're in.
Why do you define stagflation?
You have slow economic growth, but increasing prices. So yeah. There's not a ton of real economic growth. Most of the economic growth has actually been the result of increasing prices over the last year. And so that's typically where you have a low growth economy, but high prices and high inflation. This is kind of what's happened in the United States. I think the policy levers are particularly bad at this moment in terms of any government, whether it's Democratic or Republican, in terms of trying to control inflation, partly because of all the things that you have mentioned, Clark. We're talking about asset prices, supply chain disruptions, which are numerous and raising the cost of goods. I had a colleague of mine who went to a Kia dealership. He's on a wait list for a Volkswagen ID4. Went to the Kia dealership to look at an EV6 anyway. The guy told him, well, we only get once a quarter. You can have the EV6 right now, but you're going to have to pay $15,000 over list price.
Incidentally, just because I'm a car person, let me tell you that Volkswagen is dissatisfied with their ID4 and all of their electric models, and they're wiping them all out. And,
really?
And creating a completely fresh platform, which they view as more competitive.
Oh, well, okay. Okay. But it's kind of interesting because, you know, I mean, that's the level of pent up demand for cars and EVs because, you know, gas is now, what, $6, $7 in California. And so I think we're in the middle of a large market disruption and shift tied with supply chain issues that I don't think are going to go away. I mean, what's really kind of also exacerbating this is sort of beyond the control.
I think the supply chain issues will resolve over time.
Not if Xi Jinping keeps having his COVID zero policy. I don't think that's going to necessarily resolve some of the manufacturing issues, particularly because what we've relied on over the last, you know, 30 years, this is showing how thin our supply chains are. But we've relied on cheap production from potentially politically volatile places, Russian oil, Ukrainian grain, Chinese manufacturing.
I don't think we've relied on Russian oil, but certainly Chinese manufacturing.
Right. But what I'm saying is that all of these are huge confluence of events that are shaking the global markets that, you know, we certainly are the largest, you know, country in the world to try and be able to help influence those markets. But we are integrated and tied in a way that we weren't before. Untying that really is reducing supply, and it does really have an upward pressure on prices. So some of this is a natural outgrowth of both political decisions that I think we have to make. We have to support the Ukrainians.
I'm very strongly behind that.
Right. And then also the pandemic, which is still ongoing. We can't help that China wants to lock down and stamp out COVID. Semiconductors in Taiwan, same issue. They're very careful with that. And so I think there are just sort of dislocations that we're still unwinding that are going to take years to unwind.
And I think the inflation and what we're seeing are the product of natural disaster and man-made disaster.
Right, right, right. And I would agree with you there. I just don't think that, you know, this country has the policy tools at the moment or has the political will to really sort of resolve that immediately, because the policy tool that we're using now are these interest rate hikes that are designed to make it more costly to do things, which they kind of work and they kind of don't, and they can trigger a recession if you go too far. And historically, over the last 40 years, after periods of expansion where people have thought there's too much economic expansion, things are overpriced, the Fed has raised interest rates to the point where it has caused a mild recession. And so that's something that, there's a 50-50 bet. If we have to keep going on interest rate hikes after interest rate hikes, that a recession is going to come. So I'd be slightly bearish moving forward. But to put this in perspective, Alex, you lived through the great disaster that was President Salinas in Mexico with hyperinflation. So you could probably give us some context about it's bad now, but it wasn't as bad as it was in the late 80s in Mexico.
Yeah, I was still a child. I was not an adult who had been really directly affected in the sense that I, you know, wasn't working or having to maintain a family, but I was somewhat insulated from that. It was tougher, and that, you know, it meant my dad having to move out here to work and send money down there because it was going a little farther. Especially when I remember it as a child, and at some point the dollar and peso were almost equivalent. Maybe at some point it was dollar to $2, and then it jumped to 10, 20, and then like just snowballed out of control. So, I mean, I saw that, and I saw the impact it had in just forcing people to move. So you're going to see some dynamics, you know, people shifting, and that maybe not that drastic where you see an exodus from the U.S., but you're certainly going to see people moving more inland with more affordable, and you can stretch out that dollar or move out of state. And certainly you see a lot of folks going to Texas and other states, neighboring states, Arizona, because they're more affordable. So I think that's likely to happen. I think it's probably also going to, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it might force more folks to go back to school. We see that every time the economy takes a downturn, a lot of folks tend to go back to advance their education or pivot in their careers. So probably going to see that as well. There is a big shift, however, in education now that the pandemic opened up the door to more online education and all the different complications and advantages and limitations that brings. In some cases, that will help close certain achievement gaps or certain disparities. In other cases, it'll just magnify it. So we're in for it. I mean, we're in a time where we're seeing a lot of this change. And I think that's the new normal, is just that things are going to be changing fast. So I think that's what we should, maybe I should kick this back to Clark, who's more of a, likes to have more of a futurist approach and like futurist, but if I had to put on my futurist hat, I think the what we're seeing now is, in all those old ideas of, oh, we're going to go to this long, stable kind of old way of living, I think that's a ghost now. I think we just have to move forward, just be ready and willing to adapt as the world changes, and it's changing fast.
Well, this is this is what democracy does well. And this is just the exactly wrong time for the Republican Party to collectively, except for Liz Cheney and a few others, attack the foundation of America's success and America's future success.
Yeah, it's a zero sum game where the folks are in the extreme. They're just wanting to retain any shred of power and influence they have,
they're in a losing game demographically, even though sure are a lot of right wing Latinos in Florida.
Yeah, I just think that they're more willing to sink the ship.
Yeah, they just want to grab the power and hold it forever. And
right.
You see that in people like Steve Bannon, who says, instead of we're going to have a 1,000-year Reich, today he said we're going to rule for 100 years. I wish that guy would go soak his head.
Well, let's go there. Let's talk about the January 6th committee hearings. What have you noticed the most, Clark? I know you've been the most avid observer of that committee outside of among the three of us.
The thing that's infuriating to me is that a lot of this stuff was known if you simply read the news. I mean, I mean the mainstream, read the New York Times and the Washington Post. Read the coverage even in the Los Angeles Times, CNN, MSNBC. We've had good coverage. All of this is known. Yet it's very clear from the advent of these public January 6th committee hearings, that Merrick Garland and the Department of Justice is doing nothing. They're not investigating the Trump and his confederates, and I say that word confederate very intentionally. And Garland has been quoted recently as saying, "I'm watching the hearings very carefully." I mean, you should have been ahead. Right. The Justice Department should have acted a long time ago.
Right.
And I said it last time that Merrick Garland, in my view, and I'm absolutely certain the view of a lot of legal scholars, is the worst attorney general in American history, because the need for law enforcement has never been greater in the face of the worst crimes that have ever been. I often hear people say committed against our democracy. I'd say it's against our country. It's against the platform and the entity which sustains our life. And it has to do with everything that we do throughout the day, the roads, the schools, growing of food, everything that healthcare, everything that sustains our lives, and they're screwing around with it, and I believe that Donald Trump has for a long time admired dictators, because that's how he runs his business.
Right.
That's a family-owned business, and he is the absolute dictator in that business. And he just wanted to expand that paradigm to the United States. Also, I think he saw American politics as a route to power, and when he achieved power, he would consolidate it and remain there. And I think that was his plan the whole time. And we know because of these hearings that he was told that he had lost the election.
Right.
And so then he created a new campaign, and it wasn't an electoral campaign. It was a campaign to irresponsibly yell fire in a crowded theater in the context of the election. And that is to yell fire to the American people, saying this, your country is on fire because they're trying to steal. Frankly, we did win. And then go back further, way back to the presidential debates, when he says, "Proud boys, stand back and stand by." When he says that, what is he saying that for? This was all a plan.
It wasn't a well-formed plan, but it was a plan.
United States. I'd say it almost succeeded.
Right.
Very close to succeeding. And we can thank Donald Trump's native stupidity and incompetence that it failed. We can be very grateful, because I do not think that if they actually killed people, if those rioters had actually killed people in Congress, that Donald Trump would have hesitated to declare martial law.
Right.
And had he done that, we would never have another. It would be elections like they have in Russia. Well, they have elections.
That's why he was so eager to have the National Guard there, is like just so he can have some leverage and use his authority. So.
Well, that's what the Pentagon was afraid of, right?
Remember, also, Trump was replacing people.
Right.
He replaced the Secretary of Defense. He replaced the head of the National Security Agency with, Devin Nunes's attorney.
Right.
Certainly qualified, of course, to run the National Security Agency. And here's what I think he did that for, because the National Security Agency knows what the communications of Donald Trump have been with Russia. And by the way, if Trump were going to discuss this plan with anybody. I think it'd be with his buddies, his dictatorial buddies elsewhere. So they probably knew a lot about what was going on. So that has to be clamped down. The military, of course, is where in every third world junta and coup, you have the military involved, because whoever has the military has the government. So that's that. And that's one of the reasons that the Posse Comitatus Act was put in place, so that the military could not be used domestically for something like this. But that's what he was going to use it for. I am absolutely certain that Donald Trump always intended to become the greatest con man and thief in the history of the world and steal the United States. And the best way to do that is to make someone think that you that someone else was the thief and you're rectifying it.
Right. Right.
So stealing the United, the stop to steal was a pretext to steal the United States.
Well, and in that, they clearly, I think, violated a ton of laws, right, Alex?
Yeah, they did. But going back to that point, I mean, that's just what narcissists do.
That's right. Exactly.
I mean, they'll gaslight you and they'll accuse you of stuff that they're doing themselves.
Just, oh my God, that's so accurate. I've gone through a lot of stuff with a narcissist lately, and my gosh, it's exactly except in Donald Trump's, the scale is galactic instead of, you know, interpersonal.
Well, just because he has such a huge platform.
Right.
Well, let's talk about something a little less narcissistic and something happy in the last, you know, 10 minutes or so. And that's the grand opening of the Cheech in Riverside, California.
Oh, I cannot wait. It's been such a long time coming, and so many people have spent a lot of time, talent, and resources to make this a reality. I mean, I came in late into the process and I'm very fortunate to be involved in such a monumentous occasion for the region and certainly for the city of Riverside. But I mean, it's such a big statement to establish this center of kind of Latino art, basically thanks to the generosity of Cheech Marin and, you know, the wherewithal of several of the community leaders here in Riverside to say, hey, you know, this is a golden opportunity to bring this in. So I just thrilled to see what's going to happen. And I'm going to just kind of bask in the enjoyment of just seeing it come to fruition. I'm almost in disbelief that it's already here. And I mean, it's just been so transformative in many ways, and even in my personal life. And that's probably a subject for a book at some point, if I ever do go that route. But you'll get a taste of it, because I'm actually I wrote a poem for this thing, and they decided to feature it in the program. So, you know, it's an honor to just be a part of this process. And again, tip my hat to everybody that's been involved and laid that groundwork, especially initially when things were more challenging and there was less momentum. I just kind of came in once things were kind of up and running. And I'm going to continue working on this. And I just think it's going to be great for Riverside, for the Latino, Latinx community. I can't wait. I'm just overjoyed. New suit.
And a new suit, yeah. How about you, Clark? Are you excited about the new Chicano Art Museum in Riverside, the Cheech?
I actually think it's the greatest thing to happen in Riverside in the decades that I've been here. And I think it is a renaissance for Riverside that may signal a return to the glory days of the distant past of Riverside, when it was a resort for the world's elite, and when the Mission Inn was constructed, and when it was in its heyday, and when you saw Hollywood celebrities, you know, and presidents going there. But I know I've been to exhibits of Chicano art, and I think it is absolutely fantastic. And Cheech is just obvious. Cheech Marin is obviously a really smart guy, because he looked at that stuff and went, this is excellent. And he invested in it, and he collected it, and he curated it, and he presented it to the world. And the world recognizes what it is. And so the city is on the map as a vessel for, as a place of where we specialize in and celebrate Chicano art. And by the way, this goes back to years ago when I became enraptured by the writing and theories of Richard Florida, socioeconomist, who said that those cities that have that feature art and that feature music and have rock bands and gay bars and all kinds of stuff that you consider to be like, that's the leftist kind of stuff. Well, he studied cities that do that, and he compared them to cities that don't. And guess what? Cities that do that are far more economically prosperous. And I sent all that stuff to Ron Loveridge. And I have seen Riverside governance transform, beginning with Ron Loveridge. And you see more responsible people, more visionary people. I mean, at first it was like, hey, we want to look more like Claremont. And I think it's quite possible that Riverside is going to surpass Claremont, and may already have, in terms of a very livable place that mm-hmm. has economic prosperity. And it certainly has the livability aspects of a great museum, a world-class museum, and great restaurants and great people and a great culture. It's so great to go down into the downtown area and just, gosh, you see a bunch of people that you know, and everybody's talking, and you're meeting new people, and everybody's alive and enthusiastic, and like, what a wonderful place to live. And also, let's not dismiss the importance of the University of California in making it a wonderful place to live, with the economic contribution that it makes, but also the human capital, the capital of ideas and creativity and the opportunity that that catalyzes with the economic possibilities of the region, and things like what Jose Medina is proposed with AB
46.
Yeah.
But I mean, I like how you, Clark, how you blended all these two concepts, because I mean, the city's motto is arts and innovation, right?
So. Which happened after I sent that to that stuff to that was Ron Loveridge that did that. After I sent the stuff about Richard Florida, which he immediately grabbed onto. And I mean, I'm not the guy's a super intelligent guy, but I mean, the way that he directed the city after becoming the mayor, it mm-hmm. was leading to this. It created a foundation in which this could happen. Whereas had Riverside become another, I don't know, Banning or whatever, it would have never, if you didn't have people with the intellectual appetite to become what we're becoming, we would never become it.
Yeah.
I'm
biased. I was going to say the three great things that happened in Riverside: citrus, you know, the citrus, this is literally how the city blossomed into what it is now. UCR, I mean, obviously biased again, and the Cheech, you know. So somehow serendipity has been involved in all three, and citrus is really what brought my family here to the U.S. and set up roots here, no pun intended, with the citrus industry. But
I'd say going back decades, two major choices put Riverside on a course, the course it's on today, and that is putting a University of California in Riverside, hugely important. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was preserving the Mission Inn and preserving a downtown that had character and uniqueness to it.
Yeah.
If the Mission Inn were not there, it would not nearly have the character in the downtown area that it does.
So do you guys want to hear the? Want me to read you the poem that I wrote for you?
That's a great episode.
That'd be a great way to end the show.
And I wish I can channel my Edward James Olmos here to have that voice, but I'll do my best. So try to pretend as him narrating this instead of me. The poem is entitled Garden of Change. So art is a reflection of our past and a glimpse into our unwritten future. It is a beacon, a mirror, a lenticular. It is a prism that filters our rich culture into a wealth of identities. It is the comforting warmth of a woven piece of many colorful threads. Like the texture of our narrative, there are struggles and triumphs at every angle, in every canvas, an encyclopedia of emotion. And every hue resides the essence of Latinidad, its affirmation of our voices that incites imagination, artistic activism that invites social introspection, it critiques and empowers. It nourishes this garden of ideas and change. Color is the soul of light, and art is its gospel. Today we baptize this temple, this museum, a place that is both edifice and architect, sheltering ingenuity, building our community, brick by brick, heart by heart. It is love. For the many, from the many, and as one, we celebrate. Unidos in collective wisdom. And this is actually inspired on my daughter. So
that was beautiful.
You have to write an autobiography to get out the whole story, but
that's
a little plug.
That's a wonderful poem, Alex.
I do think it's a really that Chicano Latino people can take pride in the artistry, but they always could take pride in the culture, in Latin culture, because it's always been a beautiful, attractive, and actually very diverse within itself thing. I do think, though, that just as, you know, the Dutch take pride in Van Gogh and the other great Dutch artists, this art belongs to humanity and resonates with humanity because it is fantastically good. I cannot endorse it and testify to that fact enough. It's fantastically good.
And this should be the beginning of just more cultural museums that recognize it. The diverse spectrum of art that exists. You know, so many cultures are rich with their own artistic expression. And I think this could be just like the little catalyst. And, you know, we have more of these
museums. I do think it's appropriate that were here in California, which was Mexico, and that we have, and that we have such a great population, and also at the university. And I just think it's completely appropriate. I mean, it's long overdue, actually, to have a Museum of Chicano Art. And I think Cheech has established a place in history as a pretty good comedian. I mean, I've laughed at his stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is his greatest achievement. This is the being the guy who brings Chicano art to the world. And
yeah,
once you see it, you'll go, why didn't I know about this before? And why didn't I invest in Chicano art? Why didn't I, you know, he put his money with it. It was his heart that took him to this. Yeah. I mean, it resonated with him. And then he invested in it, and now it's fabulously valuable. But he didn't buy it. He didn't buy Chicano art to become wealthy. He already was wealthy. He bought it because he loved it.
And, mm-hmm.
Well, and I hope people love seeing it, because now will. It's.
I guarantee
it's,
you,
it's going to be a wonderful display. And I'm so sorry, we're all out of time. So for Clark Price and Alice Cortez, I would say go to the Cheech and enjoy it. It's a wonderful exhibit of Chicano art. And I want to thank you for listening. Tune in next time for more of the Happy Hour. Goodbye, everyone.
Bye.
Meet me at the Cheech.